From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the November 2019 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, GCHQ at 100. During World War I, the United Kingdom had two separate cryptographic organisations, the Navy's Room 40 and the Army's MI1B. Both had major code-breaking success during the conflict, but it was decided after the war that they should merge. On the 1st of November 1919, the Government Code and Cipher School, or GCNCS, was created. Best known for its work during World War II at Bletchley Park, after the war its name was changed to one more familiar to us today, GCHQ. To mark the anniversary, a special event was held exactly 100 years later, with past and present members of staff and representatives of the other Five Eyes intelligence services from around the world. We'll hear from GCHQ's current director, Jeremy Fleming, as well as memories from the staff that were specially recorded for the event. We catch up with Bletchley Park veteran Betty Webb, who shares her pride at being part of the organisation and talks about the changing role of women in defence with her guest, retired Colonel Ali Brown. Finally, we mark the retirement of a very good friend of the podcast, GCHQ's official historian, Tony Comer. The centenary event was a chance to say goodbye to Tony and meet his replacement, whose identity we can exclusively reveal in this podcast.
We were sitting there and listening to a mirror, and then, what's his name, the president at the time, he had his finger on the button, ready to press it. They'd already put the silos in Cuba to launch these missiles, and the missiles were on their way over, got so far. Anyway, then they were turning back, and that was it, red on the line where I was on, our own controller, shelling out who should go where to listen to what. And the signal came, we're turning back. Well, it was a big relief, really, wasn't it? God, that was the nearest we came, wasn't it? That was the nearest we came.
Welcome, everyone. I'm delighted that so many of you could be here today to mark this historic day. And that as things have turned out, it isn't being overshadowed by other events. I'm delighted that you're all here today in this amazing setting to help us celebrate 100 years of keeping the country safe. I'm sure that the grey skies and rain do nothing to dim the beauty and serenity of this amazing place, and I know that it won't affect our determination to mark this milestone either. And it's fitting that we're joined by so many friends and colleagues from many of the organisations without whom our successes of the past century would not have been possible. And that includes our partners in military, in intelligence, from law enforcement, academia, and industry. Some of you have travelled a really long way to get here. And I'd like to say a special thanks to our Five Eyes partners from America, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. We're also honoured to have veterans with us from Bletchley Park and a large number of former colleagues, including many of my predecessors. And of course, I'm delighted that many of the people who are still at the heart of GCHQ today are here too. They're the ones that are going to keep their backs to the cameras. Thank you all for coming. But it's not just those in the room that are taking the time to reflect on this special occasion. All across GCHQ's network, at our sites in the UK and with our partners overseas, we're marking this milestone. We're looking back at what has been achieved and reflecting on the role we will play in the next chapter of GCHQ's history. Now, 100 years ago today, at 10 a.m., a small group arrived at Watergate House in London. The day before, they'd been working in the War Office and the Admiralty, and they were brought together to form a new organisation to carry on the pioneering signals intelligence work that they'd begun during World War I. Under Alistair Denison's leadership, the newly formed Government Code and Cipher School was tasked with keeping watch on fragile global peace. We collected intelligence and we focused our efforts on making and breaking codes and on providing advice to others to enable them to communicate securely. Of course, these missions are still an essential part of what we do now as a modern intelligence, cyber and security agency. And of course, our military and our partnership with them remain as central and as strong today as they were in 1919. So that, together with our origins in World War I, make the National Memorial Arboretum a fitting backdrop for us today. The Arboretum is home to memorials of past wars and fallen comrades. The monuments you see are a reminder of the sacrifices many have made. But the Arboretum is also a living, growing tribute to those who have served and continue to serve our country today. So it's right that we're here. Now, historically, organisations like ours are clouded in secrecy, and that's for good reason. We have to retain the ability to operate in secret, to protect our capabilities and our people. That will always be true. But today's world and our work now demands a more open and transparent approach as we tackle serious cyber, terrorist, criminal, and state threats. We all know we're living through a period of accelerated technology change, which comes with unique challenges, but also huge advantages. And these mean that for GCHQ to continue to prosper, and particularly to retain our license to operate, we have to change too. Now, that's not a new thing for us. Throughout our history, brilliant minds have kept us ahead of the curve. And there are many examples. The most famous remains the amazing work at Bletchley Park during World War II. GCHQ's work to decrypt German messages, especially those encrypted on Enigma machines, made a significant contribution to the Allied victory. But it also led to technology developments which continue to shape the world today. I don't think it's too great a step to say that major innovations such as Colossus, the world's first computer, ushered in the information age. In the 1970s, work at GCHQ by mathematicians Clifford Cox, Malcolm Williamson, and James Ellis described public key encryption for the first time, and well before it was independently invented elsewhere. And this technology remains at the heart of the internet's security today. And GCHQ's integrity and tradecraft continues to have a major impact wherever I look in GCHQ today. Now, you've just heard from some of those who've been in and around our mission. Those serving today remain in the front line, whether that's defending the nation against cyber incidents, and we've seen over 1,800 of those since the National Cyber Security Centre stood up, or supporting operations that have led to 19 foiled terrorist plots in the last few years alone. It's an amazing record, but I know it's one that we've only been able to achieve because of teamwork, both within our own organisation and with our partners. The military have always been part of that story. From the lessons we learned in World War I that led to the establishment of the Government Code and Cipher School, through to our support in recent conflicts, I'm really proud that over 300 GCHQ personnel were awarded Iraq and Afghanistan campaign medals. This is a partnership that has always endured and continues to evolve. But this has never been a purely UK or a domestic effort. In World War II, we developed partnerships with intelligence agencies in the US and the other Commonwealth countries. The US were the first to arrive in Bletchley in February 1941. 10 months before Pearl Harbor. They found an organization that was bigger in scale than they'd imagined, and one that had made great inroads into the encryption challenges of the day. What would become the ACUSA, the UK-USA agreement, was signed in 1946. And in the following 10 years, the Canadians, Australians, and New Zealanders would become full partners too. And this Five Eyes relationship goes way beyond the sharing of tradecraft, data, and intelligence reporting. We share roles in each other's organizations, work together in all areas of our operations, and crucially, we share values which set us apart from our adversaries. It's a quite extraordinary partnership that plays a pivotal role in global security and stability. And it's as strong today as it's ever been. Of course, we have many friends and allies beyond the Five Eyes too. The famous breakthrough against Enigma would not have happened without a remarkable meeting in Warsaw in 1939 between the British, French, and Polish cryptanalysts. Then as now, global problems need global solutions. And that's because the challenges we face do not respect or recognize borders. A joined up response is essential, whether that's with our allies in Europe or with NATO, or working closely with MI5 and law enforcement in the UK, with MI6 overseas, and increasingly driven by our work on cybersecurity, with industry and academia too. In every sense, national security is and always will be a team effort. Now, this means for GCHQ to continue to be world-class, we have to keep recruiting and retaining the best people. We've developed a national network that helps us tap into this talent right across the country. Much of this is familiar to many of you. We're in Cheltenham, London, Bude, and Scarborough. But we're also now in Manchester, with a new facility opening in the next few months to capitalise on the diversity and vibrancy of that amazing city. And this is part of the reinvention, crucial if we want a security and intelligence mission fit for our second century, and if we want to keep inspiring the next generation of brilliant minds to want to join us. But it's not just for those who want to work inside GCHQ. Increasingly, we're using our skills and our knowledge to cultivate a diverse national pool of cyber talent to equip the country with the skills that we need to shape our digital future. Talent alone, though, is not enough. Our culture must provide space to innovate. The successes of the past have taught us that even seemingly insurmountable problems can be tackled if you bring the right people together and give them the space to imagine the impossible. In 1940, Alistair Denniston wrote to his successor, Jumbo Travis, who would later take over his role as head at Bletchley. And he said, "After 20 years' experience in the Government Code and Cipher School, I think I may say to you that one does not expect to find the rigid discipline of a battleship among the collection of somewhat unusual civilians who form GC and CS. To endeavour to impose it would be a mistake in my mind and would not assist our war effort. We must take them as they are and try to get the best out of them." So from our inception, we have always valued different perspectives and diversity of thought. No matter what problem we've been charged with solving, we've been able to find a way to work together. We strongly believe that with the right mix of minds, anything is possible. Now, I can't predict what GCHQ will look like in 100 years' time. The chances of doing that are no more than if someone had asked Alistair Denniston in 1919 to imagine the organisation I head up today. Who we are continues to be shaped by the changing threats and technology around us. But one thing's for certain. In the future, we will continue to face enormous complexity, but that will provide us also with enormous opportunity. Of course, things are hugely different to the situation in 1919. But our values, and especially our determination to keep the country safe, remains the same today. And it's this that gives me the confidence that the amazing men and women of GCHQ, working closely with all of our partners, will continue to do everything they can, day and night, to keep pioneering a new form of security well into our second century. Everyone here and in our extended network, past and present, is part of that success. And I thank you.
One person who was on the admin side, who had just regressed from being a principal to a clerical officer, was Joan Murray. And I think I did meet her on my first day there, and she was very welcoming. And she continued to be a wonderful resource in terms of history of cryptanalysis. Of course, to start with, I didn't actually realise who she really was, namely Joan Clark. And I remember shaking her hand as she left, and that actually makes me two handshakes away from Alan Turing.
And I was in my conservatory at home reading the Sunday Times, and I had a picture of this. It was an ex-motor torpedo boat, big fast craft. I had a big story about how it had been located off the coast of Spain. And I thought, yeah, that's what I did. And that gave me a huge amount of satisfaction. It was really, really, it was real singing, tangible singing. I'll always remember that.
GCHQ invited a lot of VIPs and former staff and current staff, but there were three very special VIPs who came today, and they were three of our veterans. And I'm sat here with one of them now, and that's Betty Webb. Hello, Betty.
Hello.
I spoke to you last night on the telephone, and you said what to me?
I said I didn't know why I'd been invited. Well, why would I?
It's because GCHQ becoming 100, you're part of that history. And I think today, in all the presentations, they've paid tribute to your generation, haven't they?
Yes, they have, yes, through me, which is good, yes. Because it's very important that this part of our history is not forgotten.
Now, you said a very strange thing to me, because part of the ceremony, which unfortunately we can't bring to people because it's from current members of staff, and you talked about their age, didn't you?
Well, yes. They all look so young, and are so young compared to me, but on reflection, of course, I was only 18 when I joined up in 1941, so I suppose I've got to try and relate to that.
I mean, some of those people were in their mid-20s. Now, mid-20s at Bletchley during the war, what would that have been?
Well, that was quite a bit older than I was.
Were they old men and women?
Well, in a way, yes, but there were some who were much older. It was a very large age spectrum, actually. The senior people who'd been working in Room 40 in London before they moved to Bletchley. Mm. So obviously they were sort of my parents' age group.
How does it feel for you, Betty, to think that you're part of 100 years of safeguarding our country?
It makes me feel greyer than I look.
Does it make you proud of what you did? Because I know you are.
Yes, I am now, but I don't think there's any reason for me to show off, because I just happened
to... You never
do. I happened to be there when they needed people like me to become part of the team.
No, one thing that always gets me is that I've never heard one single Bletchley Park veteran brag about what they did during World War II. You're the prime example of that, Betty, aren't you?
Well, it's only right. It would be totally undignified to be otherwise.
Because you did such a specific role. You're paraphrasing. And every time we speak, don't we? Every time I speak to you on the phone, I say, because you were so special. And all of you were. It didn't matter, you know, if it was the tea girl bringing the tea round.
Oh, that's true, yes.
But you had such a specific role with that paraphrasing, didn't you?
Well, I believe so. I don't think anybody else was given that job to do. As far as I know, I doubt it very much. And I don't know who discovered it.
What, discovered that you were good at it?
Yeah. Unless it was section head Don Parkin, who incidentally is never mentioned these days, and I don't know why. But I was in the Japanese block, Block F, which was the Burma Road.
Yes.
Sadly, no longer there, because I believe the people who took Bletchley over after the war knocked it down. That's right.
Yes, it was knocked down before the museum was created.
That's right, yes, yes. Which, of course, is very sad because it was a very important block.
Well, we know you worked there, Betty, so that's all, that's all that counts. Yes, well, your paraphrasing was quite important because you got asked to go to the Pentagon, didn't you, to do the last few months of the war?
Absolutely, yes. Complete surprise because we were lined up to go to Delhi. And then one morning, my boss called me in and he said, sorry, that's off, but you're going to America.
Now, something else I want to speak about today. It's because you're very proud of your service with the ATS, aren't you?
Well, yes, in retrospect.
And you were allowed to bring a guest today.
Yes.
Now, do you want to introduce who your guest is?
Yes, I'd like to very much, because she's a very special person in the Women's Royal Army Corps Association, and indeed her military service is considerable, and she's a very splendid person.
Hi, I'm Ali Brown, and I'm the Vice President of the Women's Royal Army Corps Association. And I was lucky enough to have a 30-year career in the British Army.
And it's only in the last few years since you've left the Army, isn't it? You're kind of back to normal now, aren't you?
Yes, I've just about adjusted to civilian street. Wearing my own clothes was a bit of a shock, but I've just about adjusted, yes.
And today, for military or ex-military, you're allowed to wear your medals and they're gleaming.
Actually, I mean, there aren't many occasions these days where veterans get to wear their medals.
No.
And I do think it's quite important visual, if like representation. And also it reminds, in a way, it reminds us of what we did and the history, you know, we come here to celebrate today, really.
Well, you've earned those medals. It seems very rude not to wear them, to be perfectly honest.
Yes, yeah.
Now, how did you get to know Betty?
I first met Betty through the Women's Royal Army Corps Association. I became the VP Vice President 4 years ago. And I became aware that our ATS contingent within the association, because we represent all women back to the First World War, were getting smaller and smaller. We were starting to lose our ATS ladies in great numbers. And I became very conscious of the fact that what we weren't doing is recording their stories. We weren't celebrating enough the service that these ATS ladies did during the war. And we operate a network of branches across the world within the association. And one of those is Birmingham branch, which is a big branch. They have huge Christmas lunches and they are a very lively, big branch. And Betty is the president of Birmingham branch. And I think I first met Betty to talk to at one of the Christmas jumper lunches, where we're all forced to wear Christmas pullovers, which is not my favourite activity, but I wore one shaped like a penguin with a big... Anyway.
But that wasn't your idea, was it,
no.
Betty?
I think Betty dislikes it as much as
yes,
I do, actually.
I've never seen Betty looking anything but very, very regally dressed. I can't imagine you in a Christmas jumper.
Betty normally wears a bit of sparkle. She doesn't wear a Christmas pullover. And that was when really we got talking. And I think that's when I realised just what a piece of history that we had through Bletchley Park. And it was also about the time that Bletchley Park was really coming to prominence. The Imitation Game film had come and gone, and the brooches were being awarded as people came out of the woodwork as having worked at Bletchley. And I think it was talking to Betty at that Christmas lunch and also her stories of going to Washington in 1945 that really sparked my interest. So I went back to Association Headquarters and said, look, we've really got to start putting these ladies front and centre. Every single event, every single opportunity we get to talk, let's lead with the story of these ATS ladies.
Because it's a history that up till recently hasn't really been told,
no,
has it?
Hasn't.
Not just the ladies of Bletchley, but women serving
women in
general.
Yes. Normally, if you ask a member of the public what a veteran is, they will say an elderly bloke with medals.
Yeah.
Us women were strangely reticent. I'm not really sure why we're so reticent about what we did. You've heard it from Betty. You know, we don't like to brag. We celebrate our service, but we don't do it enough. And that's why I'm very keen to get women's stories out there. And we've just published a book called 100 Wonderful Women. And Betty's front and centre in that book.
Ali is also in it.
Yes, but we take the story of women all the way through from the First World War. And the fact remains, whether Betty likes it or not, that if it wasn't for what the ATS did during the war, I wouldn't have had the career that I had, because they laid that road for me to follow. It's as simple as that.
You see Ali as like following on your tradition, don't you, two generations later?
Very much. Yes, absolutely. And of course, nobody better to do it.
Every time you speak about Ali on the phone to me, you've got such pride when you talk about her.
Very kind. How embarrassing.
I know. I'm trying to make one of you cry.
It's not very embarrassing, but when I know what she went through to earn those medals, it's not everybody's cup of tea.
And yet I feel really fortunate to be in the army when I was, because the role of women was just wider and wider and wider the longer I served.
Yeah.
And so I had the opportunity to deploy on operations. So I feel quite fortunate that I did join the army when I did. Because before that, it was Germany, Germany and Germany and yeah. Northern Ireland. So when I was in the 80s and 90s, we did get that chance to deploy an operational service.
And you've become quite a chauffeur for Betty now, God, haven't
yes,
you, recently?
I have. But Betty has just about got used to my sat-nav. This woman's voice every now and then comes on and tells me when to turn around. And that did
yes.
surprise you first time,
yes,
didn't
yes.
it?
Oh, yes.
But yes, I mean, I drive a lot with the association, so it's really no hardship.
And I think you accompanied Betty to... When she explained this to me, I was a little confused and wondering how it would happen. But let's just say a talk and a portrait.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
I can. We were lucky enough to go into partnership with the National Army Museum this year to celebrate our centenary. And in addition to our exhibition that they had a series of portrait paintings of five of our members, taking us through from the Second World War all the way through to the current day. And Betty was one of the five that I cajoled, persuaded. I didn't put myself forward for it. I just chose other people. So Betty was first up, and it was an evening at the National Army Museum where the head painter from the London Institute of Fine Arts painted Betty's portrait while she was delivering her story. So we were all lucky enough to see this canvas sort of come to life.
Tessa.
Yes, being interviewed by Tessa Dunlop. And it was a really entertaining, interesting evening, and seeing this face emerge, you know, from the canvas, and then the Bletchley brooch being painted,
which
really kind of put the seal on the portrait. It was really good.
This is the thing, Betty, you always put Bletchley first, don't you?
I try.
You know, you've had a few health problems in the last few years, and every time you've come through one of these, your first thoughts are, when can you get back on the horse and start telling Bletchley story, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. Otherwise, my life would be very empty.
Well, I'd just like to say, Betty, because I don't know if I'm sure I have, but just in case I haven't, thank you for your service, and thank you for your continuing service, Betty.
Well, I hope I'm going to be able to continue it.
And I hope at the age you are, which isn't, but I hope you're having a happy 100th birthday.
Yes,
because,
so do I. I know it was going to be a nightmare organising.
Well, you'll have had two, because you'll have had today's with GCHQ.
Yes.
And then your own, whenever that is.
And the association 100th birthday, which was in March of this year.
Yes.
So
that's celebrated as well. She gets three. And I would just like to say I use Betty shamelessly. Every opportunity I get, I give her a call and say, come on, if you're free, we're going.
Well, that's
so I would just
brilliant.
Like to say thank you as well.
And Ali, can I say thank you for your service as well?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
I knew I wanted to do a placement year when I started university, and I wanted my work to make a difference, to matter. And then when I started looking at organisations to apply for, I knew GCHQ was one of them because, you know, it's prestigious, it's world renowned, and it's in cybersecurity, which is really important to the UK.
I'd be on leave when WannaCry broke. The ransomware attack on the health service. I remember coming in on the Saturday morning for one of the first cross Whitehall event meetings and just looking around the room and thinking everybody was there who you needed to have there. By the Saturday evening, NCSC had guidance for the individual, guidance for a small and medium-sized enterprise or, you know, doctor surgery or something, and then advice for big enterprises, and it was clearly signposted and labelled and it was all there.
For me, on a personal level, it's certainly changed the course of my career because it's as a result of 7/7 that I won't work any other mission. We have huge opportunities working at GCHQ. You can do lots and lots and lots of different jobs on different missions. But for me, so long as I've got something useful to offer counterterrorism, I will stay working counterterrorism. So it's been, 15 years almost now, and I intend to stay there for the rest of my career.
Over the entire life of the podcast, we've had the amazing help of GCHQ's official historian, who these days I can call Tony Comer, but originally could only say was the historian, and that was it. It seems somewhat fitting that the last time we will have him on the podcast is from today's event. Tony, what did today mean to you?
It meant a series of things. It meant an end to the centenary year, an end to all of the work that we've put in to celebrating 100 years of GCHQ. It means an end to 3 or 4 years of more or less detailed planning. It means, for me, a sort of end to my career on a really high note as we go out with a sort of blaze of positive publicity about what the organisation's for and what it does. And I suppose also it's a thing about the start of the next 100 years. And one of the things that you've been lucky enough to hear today is a bunch of very young junior members of staff who, I must admit, are as inspiring to me as our predecessors are.
As Betty Webb was saying in the interview that I've done with Betty, she herself was really proud of those, what she called young people, and was surprised how young they were. I did have to point out to her that she was only 18 when she started at Bletchley, so it's a similar thing. For someone who's coming up to retirement, as you are, most people wind down. I'd imagine this last year's been probably one of your busiest years ever, hasn't it?
It's been extremely busy. It's involved a lot of media stuff. It's involved a lot of public speaking. I've felt a bit like Frank Sinatra doing a round-the-world farewell tour. I've got more stamps in my passport for the United States for this year than I have probably for the last 4 years put together. And it has been busy, but I've been very lucky because since June, my successor has been on board. GCHQ have been incredibly good by allowing us a 14-month handover. So while I have been very busy, I can actually say that not only is the end in sight, but I've got somebody to whom I can hand over this job and be quite content that I'm leaving it in hands that are more than capable of taking the job forward and transforming it into something new.
And that's the perfect point to introduce the man himself.
Hello. So my name's David Abrutat. I joined GCHQ in 2002. Prior to that, I've spent many years in academia and in the military. I spent most of my career in GCHQ working in operations, and I'm very passionate about our organisation, what binds us together, what makes us tick, and the history is very much part of that. And the iconic history that we've got with Bletchley Park and World War II is very much in the public gaze, but we've got such a rich history as being displayed today with our centenary celebration at the Arboretum.
We've only met a few times, but already I can tell the passion that you've got for the history of the organisation. It means so much to you, doesn't it?
It does. I've seen what a genuine difference that SIGINT makes to our country and to our partnerships with other agencies overseas and to agencies in the UK. And it's been a privilege to work for the organisation for the length of time I have. But yeah, I'm taking over from Tony, and I've got some very big shoes to fill because I've got a lot of respect for Tony. I've worked with him for many years on some of the military history sort of projects that I've been pursuing outside work.
Because you've written a couple of books, haven't you?
I have, yeah. Certainly the World War II era is just fascinating to me. But that period of time has to now expand to 100 years. So I've got to learn, you know, going back to the First World War right up to the present day. It's a big ask, but something I love a challenge, and I'm looking forward to taking on responsibility of the role.
That's something probably people won't realise. I'm guessing Dave will have to be involved with whatever's released next, won't he? So we're talking about Cold War by then, aren't we?
Yeah. I mean, we've started releasing Cold War intelligence reports. We started quite a few years ago to do that. But one of the consequences of publishing John Ferris's authorised history of GCHQ, the book that's unfortunately not coming out this year, it'll be coming out in October 2020, is that we promised that following on from publication of the book, we would do a release to complement the book, a release of the documents, yeah, as much as possible of the documents that John Ferris cites. And that's all going to happen under Dave's gaze.
So have you managed to get away with not doing that then?
It looks, as a complete byproduct of the book being late, that that will be entirely Dave's business and not mine. And I'm not going to pretend that I'm dreadfully unhappy about that.
So you're looking forward to that then, Dave?
Yes, the poison chalice is being passed across.
Tony, I mean, we've spoken about how much the organisation has changed for you while you've been here. How many years service will you have done by the end of your career?
By the time I finish, I've done 37 years.
And you started actually in operations, didn't you?
Exactly. This is my first ever non-operational job. So I've worked as a linguist. I've worked supporting the military. I was the UK rep on the NATO seeking committee. You know, I've had a lot of deep operational experience, but I must admit, none of it has been as much fun, as challenging, or has given me as much personal satisfaction as doing this job. And working with you, working with the Bletchley Park Trust, has been an absolute highlight for me. I mean, where else have we had, until very recently, where we've been able to talk about the work of SIGINT? Where else have we been able to showcase things? And where else have we had volunteers who, in talking about the subject they're interested in, which is the history of Bletchley, 39 to 45, which sounds a bit like a mastermind special subject, yeah, doesn't it? But think how much the people who are so passionate about Bletchley's history have done for us in telling SIGINT stories and making the work that happened at Bletchley Park come alive for so many visitors and so many people who read about it.
It would be easy for the general public to look at GCHQ as this big, scary organisation, you know, that are listening to everyone. Yeah. Now, any of us who understand the organisation realise it's not that. You're there just to protect us. But it's a good in for GCHQ to have had that history, isn't it?
It is. And remember something that goes right back to when you and I think, first knew each other, when Sir Ian Lobban, his speech at Leeds University during the Turing centenary. And one of the points that he made about GCHQ was that GCHQ isn't just a headquarters building in Cheltenham, and it's not just the National SIGINT organisation as defined in the Intelligence Services Act 1994.
Yeah.
It's also the sum of all of the people who work in SIGINT and all of the people who have worked in SIGINT. Yeah. It's our collective experience as well. And I think that's one of the things that makes it such a satisfying place to work, and perhaps a reassurance to people who do think it might be this big, scary spy organisation. How can all these tens of thousands of citizens, yeah, fellow citizens, have been some sort of crook or some sort, yeah, of master spies or some sort of surveillance freaks or anything like that? I know it's a cliche. It's ordinary people doing extraordinary work, yeah, but just because it's a cliche doesn't mean that it's not true. That's the bit of our history that I like to think I'm a part of. I'm a single part of it. I'm handing my part over to Dave. And in some years' time, Dave will hand over to someone else. And that thread just runs through the whole of our history, that we are fellow citizens whose job it is to protect our country and the people who live there.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, also, GCHQ can't be that scary and big brothery, because they let me in there, didn't they?
Yeah, but I suppose everybody makes a mistake from time to time.
Tony, can I just say, on behalf of the listeners and personally, thank you so much for everything that you've done for us, everything that you've done for GCHQ, and everything you've done for Bletchley Park as well. And on top of that, can I just say thank you for your service?
Thanks very much. You have moved me. It's not often that I am stuck for words, but you've managed it. Well done, Mark. Thank you.
I remember literally working through the night in the office, you know, passing reporting on to FCO members of staff, and then finding out early in the morning that the hostage had actually been released through a military operation. and being able to look out over Downing Street and seeing the Prime Minister making a statement to that effect.
I think the proudest moment of my career is probably when we got the phone call to say that we'd managed to stop the patrol from going up the road with the IEDs because we'd got the information to them in time and everybody was back and they were all alive. That was probably the most stressful day of my career, but also a really proud moment of knowing that GCHQ made a real difference that day.
It does give you, you know, a certain sense of pride when you are the fourth generation to work somewhere. Like, you do feel like you're carrying a little bit of a legacy, and it's just nice to give, it's not so much legitimacy, but it's like a sense of you're carrying it forward to people that have been here before.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.